People can be afraid of lots of things, perhaps even saying the word needle, snake, or small confined space makes you start to clam up. We're going to learn about the most common phobias this hour and how to overcome the fear and learn if it's even possible to conquer a phobia. Karen Cassaday is with us. She's president of the Anxiety and Depression Association of America and owner of the Anxiety Treatment Center of Greater Chicago. She's also a clinical professor at the Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science. Karen, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Kate. Glad to be here.
Well, what exactly defines a phobia?
Well, a specific phobia happens when someone has a fear about a circumscribed situation and it interferes with their daily living. And so a lot of us might not like bugs or snakes or feel a little uncomfortable if, you know, we're very, you know, on the 50th floor looking over the balcony. But a phobia is more than that. It's when someone is crippled by the fear. And so they experience a rush of physical symptoms like heart racing, shaking, sweating, feeling intense dread. And then they feel an intense desire to avoid the thing that they're phobic about. And then they find it very, very difficult to be in that situation. So, for example, when I've had people who are afraid of snakes, if they think they see one in the yard, then they can't go outside and garden if they really like gardening, or they won't go to the Southwest where they know there's a lot of snakes. Or I've had patients who have difficulty with fear of heights, and then they might not be able to visit someone who lives in a tall, high-rise building or be able to, you know, do things where other people could go because there's a balcony. Or they might not be able to go near the window if they're on the third story.
Do we know what's happening internally in the body? How some bodies are hardwired, have this disposition to have a phobia?
Well, at this point, we think that it's a combination of you probably inherited the tendency to get a specific phobia. So chances are there's people in your families or family that have had trouble with other anxiety disorders or mood disorders. And then the interesting thing about specific phobias is they tend to come on between the ages of 7 and 9, just out of the blue. And so a lot of people misunderstand it as something bad had to have happened. And that seems to happen in only about 20% of the people that have a specific phobia, where they get, you know, there's a neighbor's dog who barks a lot and is scary, and then they become very fearful of dogs. But it just spontaneously arises. And then we also know that people who get phobias have a body that learns how to get afraid much faster than other people's. Hmm. And so they could have one episode where they get this reaction, and then it's like their body sort of instantly conditions. And we also believe that they're getting a stronger fear response than other people might have that don't get phobias. And so those combinations of things seem to make it easier to develop a phobia if you inherited that tendency.
Can a phobia improve over time or lessen or get worse for that matter?
Well, that's a great question. Unfortunately, what seems to happen is people have this come up in childhood, and it stays that way for their entire life. And what we do know is the more someone avoids the situation that they fear, the worse it gets. And so someone, you know, for example, could start out with a fear of clowns, as a child. And then they decide, I'm never going to the circus, I'm never going near that, I can't look at pictures. And it could get to where by the time they're adult, they have an extremely strong response to anything that has to do with a clown. And that can include pictures, movies, real people, who are actually clowns. And it can become very disabling for the person.
Karen Cassaday is with us. She is president of the Anxiety and Depression Association of America and owner of the Anxiety Treatment Center of Greater Chicago. She's also a clinical professor at the Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science. You can join in the conversation about phobias, 800-642-1234. Do you have phobias or extreme fears that interrupt your life? How do you manage or cope with your phobia? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Karen, how common is it to have a diagnosed phobia?
Well, we know that about 19 million Americans suffer from specific phobia. It's the most common anxiety disorder, and it occurs in about 17% of the population. So that's a really large number. And the most common ones tend to be things like bugs, insects, snakes, and heights, and spiders. And, you know, many people or scientists have theorized that, you know, those things may be there for sort of a evolutionarily adaptive advantage, you know, because there's poisonous snakes. If you're on cliffs or heights, it could be bad. But you can be, you know, phobic about all kinds of unusual things. So I've had patients who are afraid of things that are underneath the water, like the hull of a boat or a buoy, or things that are holes. Kim Kardashian or one of the Kardashians, you know, has a phobia of that. And so about a year ago, that was all over the news. Mm. It could be sticky things like tape or glue, you know, as well as things that sort of makes sense, you know, like, the, you know, heights or the dentist, medical procedures, getting injections, seeing blood, things like that. The list is actually infinite. If it's out there, then someone could develop a phobia about it.
And is a clinical diagnosis, is it pretty clear and somewhat easy to make a clinical diagnosis and then figure out a treatment for it? Or are phobias just kind of lingering out there as self-diagnosed?
Well, actually, we do have specific criteria for someone, you know, to be diagnosed with a specific phobia. And it's actually very easy to diagnose someone because it's a particular object or situation that the person has, and then it interrupts their daily living to a significant amount. And so it's more than just not liking something. It actually has to make life difficult for people. And then also it has to do with how easily someone can avoid it. So, for example, you know, if you're in a large city like Milwaukee or Chicago where there's high rises and you have a fear of heights, it's more bothersome than if you're working on a farm, you know, in the middle of Wisconsin. So, you know, that can kind of affect it there. And then the interesting thing about it is this is actually probably the most treatable of all the anxiety disorders. And when we use a simple therapy called exposure therapy, and we help the person, usually about 90% of the people who undergo that treatment are able to recover.
What do you mean by exposure therapy?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kate. Exposure therapy is where you gradually approach the situation you fear and you stay in it until your anxiety naturally subsides. And it's kind of like riding a roller coaster that you don't like over and over and over. And what happens is each time, the receptors in your brain and body for all the fear chemicals fill up, they saturate, and then they have to downregulate before they can fill up with more chemicals. And so if you repeatedly stay in a situation you fear, what will happen is your body will get used to it. We call that process habituation. And whether you changed your mind or not, your body will start to relax. And it'll stop having that horrible panic reaction that you get. And And then your mind, of course, will realize, hey, this isn't so bad. I can handle it. And you can get over it. And so we can literally do single session treatment where I, you know, borrow some snakes and have someone come in, and we're getting to where we can approach the snakes, look at them, handle them, and do that in a matter of 2 to 3 hours. And someone can then experience substantial improvement and become comfortable.
Phobias, many people have them. They tend to cluster around themes like, say, fear of heights, or animals are in the phobia lineup. We were just listening to how to get over snakes. Understanding how to manage these phobias, when to know it's time to seek help, with Karen Cassaday. She is president of the Anxiety and Depression Association of America and owner of the Anxiety Treatment Center of Greater Chicago. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have phobias or extreme fears that interrupt your life? Let's talk about them. 800-642-1234. Insects and other animals top the list of common phobias among 4.7% of all adults, followed by mountains, tall buildings, bridges, and other heights. 4.5% of adults identify with that grouping. This data comes from a very large survey of adults in the U.S., the findings of which were published in the journal Psychological Medicine a decade ago. We're talking phobias this hour, how to manage them, with Karen Cassaday. She is president of the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, owner of the Anxiety Treatment Center of Greater Chicago. She's also a clinical professor at the Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a phobia that you live with? When did you notice you developed the fear? Is there anything you can do to avoid the effects of a certain phobia? 800-642-1234. Let's go to Becky, who joins us from McHenry, Illinois. Hi, Becky.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Well, my fear is balloons, which is crazy enough. I've had it all my life. I wouldn't let my kids get balloons when we go to the bank. They'd offer them balloons. I'd be like, no. We couldn't stay at birthday parties if there was balloons. There's always balloons at birthday parties. So we'd have to leave. It's even affected my jobs that I've had, believe it or not. You would think it wouldn't be an issue, but when they do the, you know, parties or whatever, they always bring out the balloons, and I always have to go and say, oh, I'm afraid of balloons. I can't be near them. It's really bad.
And Becky, is it what aspect of the balloons where you feel this fear? Is it what they're made of? Is it where they can go? What is it about balloons?
I think it's the fact that I know they're going to pop,
but
I don't know when.
Yeah. Well, Becky, I'm glad you called in, because, you know, you're not alone. And you mentioned something that many people do who have specific phobias, is they feel embarrassed by it, and they feel like, I must be going crazy, because they're, you know, logically able to say, okay, I see that others aren't afraid. This shouldn't be such a big deal, yet my body gets so scared. It feels very, very difficult. And then a lot of people don't seek treatment because they don't know that there is treatment available, or they dread the thing they're scared of so much they just can't imagine how you could possibly get over it.
Well, Becky, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that phobia. Let's go to Andrew, who joins us in Milwaukee. Hi, Andrew.
Hey.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I have a fear of needles. Whenever, you know, the thought of a needle or seeing a needle going into somebody, I get lightheaded and nervous and anxious.
And yeah. Andrew, when you go to the doctor, do you have this fear as well, regardless of whether there will be a needle present?
Yeah, definitely.
And so, Andrew, have you been able to get all your vaccinations that you needed, or you know, or have you ever avoided getting medical treatment or vaccinations?
Yeah, definitely. It's on the bottom of my list of things to do when it comes to my
right.
health.
Yeah, or how about dental treatment?
It's interesting. Dental treatment has been okay. For numbing and whatnot. I don't know if it's because I don't see the needle that it helps.
Yeah.
But not seeing it.
Yeah, I would assume it's because you haven't seen it, and I'm really glad for you, because frequently people who have, we call it a blood or injury phobia, who have that, have great difficulty with medical treatment, including dental care. You know, the interesting thing that you mentioned was that you can feel like you can faint. And when people have blood injury phobias, one thing that can go along with that is what we call a vasovagal response, where initially when you see or hear about the thing that you're scared of, your heart rate increases and then it plummets, and it plummets low enough that you might feel faint or actually faint. And then that can complicate things for people because they're afraid of having that happen too. And, you know, this seems to, you know, contrary to popular opinion, men don't faint more than women. It's just some people have this, and it's unique to this particular phobia. And so when we're doing treatment for people who have this phobia, besides doing the exposure therapy where we have you look at pictures or films or videos that have to do with giving blood, getting injections, then looking at and handling needles or IV equipment, and then working up to being able to stick yourself with those little diabetic lancet needles, and then being able to work up to giving blood or getting shots or giving yourself small saline injections, sterile saline injections. We also teach people to avoid fainting. And there's a very simple cure for that, and that is to learn how to keep your heart rate up at about 90 beats per minute by wiggling the large muscles in your body. And that usually means wiggling your legs or squeezing your backside muscles or thigh muscles, and practicing that until you can keep your heart rate up, and that can keep you from fainting. And, you know, and this is something where the treatment can go quite rapidly. It's really finding someone who does exposure therapy.
Mm. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for calling in and discussing your fear of needles. We're with Karen Cassaday. She is president of the Anxiety and Depression Association of America and the owner of the Anxiety Treatment Center of Greater Chicago. Talking about phobias this hour, do you cope with one? Is there an extreme fear that you have? Perhaps you don't know whether it rises to the level of phobia. Does it impede your life? 800-642-1234. You can ask your question, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Karen, many people have a fear of flying, and a lot of people have to figure out how to board that airplane, how to manage what is going on inside of them. Does the fear of flying elevate to a phobia? When does that happen, and how do you address it?
The fear of flying most certainly can be a phobia, and you know, there's a lot of white knuckle flyers where they, you know, if they have to fly, they are extremely uncomfortable. And the most common way people handle that is by drinking alcohol. And certainly alcohol can relax you, but we don't recommend that as a solution. Or people might get anti-anxiety medication called benzodiazepines. People might know the name, like Xanax or Valium or Klonopin, to help them fly. But you can do the cognitive behavioral treatment very successfully, and that would be, we have to first identify what is it that's making flying difficult. Because with fear of flying, you have some people where their fear is about the plane crashing.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's turbulence or just the fact that they're up in the air several miles makes them very frightened about crashing. Or it could be a variant of panic disorder where someone is not so much afraid of the plane crashing, but they're afraid they'll have a panic attack on the plane and they'll, you know, go out of control. And what if they were to try and open the door or just lose their mind from panic? And so you have to treat each of those things accordingly. If it's the specific phobia of crashing, what we do is we have people first imagine crashing and make sort of like a, we call it imaginal exposure, where we imagine over and over what would happen during a crash, what it would be like. And people habituate to their imagination, and they get to where it's an unpleasant thought, but it doesn't provoke terror. And it's the same thing that would happen if you've ever watched a horror movie a second or a third time. The second or the third time, it just doesn't pack the same punch that it did the first time you saw the movie. And then we get people to practice flying. And so there's different ways that you can do that. So one might be, you know, if you do it with a therapist or with a support person, is to take a very short flight. You know, for example, from Milwaukee to Chicago, it's 10 minutes. And you can practice waiting for the flight, being on the plane. We also have people practice slowing down their physiologic response. So learning how to breathe diaphragmatically so that you trigger your body to calm down. Learning how to relax. People can use meditation, yoga, relaxation exercises. The nice thing about smartphones now is you can download all kinds of free apps that have to do with meditation, relaxation. And at UCLA, if you Google UCLA meditation, you can get a wonderful array of different types of relaxation sequences and meditation sequences that you could try out ahead of time and find out which one you prefer, and then download that onto your phone and put it in, you know, put your earbuds in and use that while you're waiting for the flight or getting on the plane or sitting on the plane. If someone has panic disorder, that's a little more complicated. And what we do with that is we do what we call interoceptive exposure, where in the office we practice inducing the physical sensations you're afraid of. So if you're afraid of your heart racing, we run in place or run up and down steps. If you're afraid of getting dizzy, we spin in a chair and we stand up and spin around. If you're afraid of feeling weird and woozy and uncomfortable, then we hyperventilate acutely so that you lower the carbon dioxide level in your blood and get all these odd sensations of panic. And once someone habituates to that, then we try to get into enclosed situations, such as being in a plane, where we can simulate that, like driving as a passenger in the back of a car on a busy expressway. Or frequently people who have that panic disorder and fear flying, fear being in elevators, being a passenger in a car. Or we find those virtual reality rides at the Children's Science Museum, you know, where you can get in there and the hatch closes in.
Right, right.
And practice riding that. And then so, if someone can do that, then we bring on the symptoms while you're doing it. And by then, pretty much someone's ready to try flying.
Yeah, you're really tackling these phobias and meeting them head on. Let's address public speaking here, and let's go to Tom in Burlington. Hi, Tom.
I'm afraid of speaking in front of people. I've been on your radio show many, many times. I can talk on the telephone, but being in front of people, it's practically terrifying to me. And then I tried the diaphragm breathing, which is a whole different field, and but anyway, I write music, and I was asked, it was the first time I ever got up to play in front of people, I hid behind the speakers. Nobody even saw me. But I'd like to ask this question about diaphragm breathing, because a friend of mine, his son is having these seizures, and I was trying to tell him that if you breathe deeply, your body will get oxygen.
Well, let's let Karen go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, what you're doing when you breathe diaphragmatically is you're slowing down your rate of breathing, ideally to 8 respirations a minute. So, you know, 4 counts in, 4 counts out, or lower. And that triggers your parasympathetic nervous system, the part of your nervous system that calms your body and brings you back to baseline. So just that rate will do it. And then also what you're doing is you're avoiding over-exhaling carbon dioxide. Because the counterintuitive thing is that when we're at rest or, functioning normally, we have more carbon dioxide in our blood than oxygen. And when we have too low a level of carbon dioxide, then it creates all these odd sensations. And so the idea is you're trying to breathe gently. And also we know that the majority of air exchange is in the bottom third of your lungs and very efficiently. And that can help calm the body, and it takes some training. And also it's hard to do if you're really scared. The fear of public speaking is actually our most common fear in the United States. We know at the American Academy of Cardiology, and this was in the old days where they'd have all the pharmaceutical samples, we found that about 72 or 73% of the speakers there were self-administering medication called beta blockers to help suppress their anxiety when they made presentations.
Oh, my goodness.
And we know that with the fear of public speaking, the thing that people are afraid of is people's attention and accidentally feeling foolish or making a mistake. And so when we're doing exposure with that, what we try to do is to have people practice flubbing and making a mistake and being in front of people in a gradual fashion where they're drawing attention to themselves but not doing it perfectly, and then discovering that people are actually quite generous and that they're not focusing on your mistakes. They don't know how the song was supposed to sound. They're just getting an impression. And then I have it on good account from many musician friends, there's almost never a perfect performance.
Let's bring
so that
in
would be my suggestion. Yeah.
Let's bring in Chrissy now in Burlington as well. Chrissy, what about public speaking?
Hello?
Hi, Chrissy, are you there?
Yes, I am here, and it was kind of I was really listening to what you just said to that gentleman. I'm currently in a position in my job where it requires me to attend these networking meetings. So at any given time, I have to stand up, introduce myself, and say a little bit about what I do. And it's maybe in front of 20 to sometimes 50 people. And my main thing is as it's going around the table or the room and it's getting closer and closer to my time to speak, I can feel my heart rate raising and my heart practically where it's like beating out of my chest. And no matter how much I rehearse and I know what I'm speaking about, I almost don't even hear myself speaking to know the content of what I'm speaking about.
Karen.
Yeah. You are describing such a common experience, and I'm confident there are readers there that as you were saying that, their heart was racing because they have the same experience. And when someone has that type of situation, what we do in treatment is several things. So one is we try to find situations that feel like they're lower stakes, such as joining Toastmasters, or if you go to church and you have an opportunity to volunteer to just do the opening prayer or the closing prayer, or to, somehow or read the scripture in front of everyone. To use those opportunities and then to deliberately do things that appear to be less than polished.
We're talking phobias this hour with Karen Cassaday. She is president of the Anxiety and Depression Association of America and clinical director. You can join in this conversation, 800-642-1234. What is your question about phobias? We'll return after these headlines. Phobias can cause extreme anxiety and even prevent a person from living a normal life. For example, a person who fears enclosed spaces tight spaces and are what we call claustrophobic, they might not be able to ride that elevator. There's also a fear of flying that we've been discussing. Phobias This Hour with Karen Cassaday. She is president of the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, owner of the Anxiety Treatment Center of Greater Chicago. She's also a clinical professor at the Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science. How to live with them, how to know if your fear rises to the level of a phobia. Join in 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to Becky, who joins us from Waterford. Hi, Becky, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. My phobia is rooted with a child, I don't know if you want to call it a trauma. I fell very, very hard on the ice in my driveway running for the school bus when I was about 8. I'm 40 right now, and walking on glare ice is absolutely crippling for me. It makes me hyperventilate. It has brought me to tears in public. I have gotten down on my hands and knees in order to get from one place to another. I can do it because I live in Wisconsin. My husband loves to ice fish, and I want to go, so I muscle through it, but my knees lock up. I walk like Frankenstein. I am so nervous, and I'm just wondering, is it maybe in conjunction with a lack of confidence issue, because I'm almost positive every time I walk on ice, I'm going to fall, even though I don't. And I'm just wondering, because I am exposed to that every single winter, because I live here, how can I get over this?
Well, you're asking a great question. We find that having a specific phobia can compromise your self-esteem because people feel so foolish. But having a low self-esteem does not cause a specific phobia. So people can be very confident in other areas of their life. And, you know, my suggestion to you, Becky, would be once it freezes up, that the first thing you do is stand with half your foot or a quarter of your foot on the clear ice, you know, not your whole body, and just stay there. And don't try and move around, and do it until your body starts to slow down and relax. And if you can, try to just breathe through your nose instead of your mouth, and that'll cut down the amount of carbon dioxide you over exhale. And then scooch out a teeny bit more. And I would, you know, do that until you can just stand on it without freezing up, you know, holding stiffly. You want to try and relax and slightly bend your knees. And the idea is you want to try and be able to breathe slowly and gently. And once you can just stand there without panicking, and this may take a while, then to move in little one-inch increments, just one, you know, forward or backward, and then just stand there and until you can relax. And build up to where you could do some very small shuffle steps without doing the, you know, the clench and the hyperventilating. And, you know, keep building up like that gradually. And part of the problem that happens when people have a phobia like that is they're frustrated. They're trying to push themselves, and they're saying self-critical things like, no, oh, God, I can't believe this. Or they're panicking about the fact they're panicking. And the idea would be for you to gradually help yourself be near or be on clear ice without having to do anything. You know, you don't have to get over to where the fishing hole is. Your goal is just to be there long enough so that your body can habituate. And if you're willing to be patient and wait, you have a good snowsuit on, then that ought to help.
It sounds like this too initiated, this came on from a specific childhood trauma. And that this phobia was perhaps very much linked to this incident of falling on ice.
Absolutely. And I would imagine, you know, Becky's family has people who have anxiety disorders in it. And so if you inherit that tendency, then it's very easy to develop a phobia if you have an unpleasant experience like that.
Becky, thanks for calling in. Let's go to Anne, who joins us from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I think our family has a few phobias running through it, too. But the one I'm concerned about now is my 3.5-year-old granddaughter, who is scared of several things, like mascots or big costume things in parades. She's getting better about that. But the one that's most debilitating is that she is terrified of dogs. And Christmas is coming. My sister has two little dogs, which I personally find annoying also. But it's hard to keep her away from them because to my sister, the dogs are her children. To my daughter, her daughter is her child. And we're all going, ah. So do you think this is the start of a phobia or will she grow out of this? You know, what do we need to do?
Unfortunately, it sounds like it's more likely this could be going in the wrong direction. And so the thing that would really help is if you can find other people's dogs that are really calm and obedient and can just sit still, preferably a little one, and then play with, your granddaughter and help her gradually look at the dog and then scooch a little closer to the dog. And help her habituate where you gradually just try to get closer to the dog. And you need a dog that will be quiet and still. And to get to where she can go up and she can look at the dog and maybe even touch the dog, without having to have the dog try and encounter her. And then if a child can do that, then we like to put peanut butter on their hands because dogs love peanut butter, and then to let the dog lick the peanut butter off her hand or put it on her toes and have the dog lick her toes where it kind of tickles. So there's a fun thing. And then if you can find a slightly larger dog that's calm, to do the same thing again where she gets to practice approaching the dog. And then trying to find if there's a neighbor dog that barks some, where you just get to stand at a distance and the dog barks and then gradually approach the dog as it's barking without avoiding, and get her to look at the dog and to notice the dog smiling and it's friendly. That would be my suggestion. And then also having her watch videos of barking dogs until she can look at it and pat the screen and say, oh, the dog's just talking. And so with young children, I explain barking is how dogs talk. It just sounds scary, but it's their way to say, hi, I see you, you're there. And so that would be my suggestion. But I would encourage your sister to not let the dogs run around freely and bark and jump all over her. That'll make things worse unless you can do the kind of things I described.
Anne, thank you so much for bringing that up, especially as we approach the holidays. Tia from Madison emailed, who has a fear of clustered holes but doesn't know what that is exactly, suffers from this fear of seeing clustered holes, immediately feels dirty, has to have a shower. The sight of holes making Tia cringe to the point where Tia is ready to have a tantrum. How to get over this?
Well, that is it's a disgust response, and that's common with phobias like this. And the easiest way to do this is to get pictures of these type of things, like dried lotus blossoms, some of these dried flowers they use in arrangements, and to start by looking at it and trying to, slow yourself down and calm, and then to reframe it and to say, this isn't disgusting, it's just something that I don't like. Mm. So you try to minimize that disgust response and get to where you can touch the picture, look at the picture for a sustained time, and get different pictures. If you go on the internet, you can find all kinds of horrifying, disgusting images related to this, and to work up to the most difficult ones, and then to try to go to floral shops, and you can buy dried blossoms that look like that to bring them home, and to do the same thing where you try to look at it longer, touch it. Normally with phobias, people do not want contact with the thing they're scared of. And so you want to be able to touch it and let your disgust response subside. And that would help someone get over that. We've treated patients who've had that exact fear, and It can go very successfully if you take this approach.
And we have time just to fit in one more question about a fear of guns, the sound of them. Mackenzie in Appleton says scares Mackenzie. It scares them when watching movies. Is there a way to prevent prevent this from happening when seeing guns or hearing guns?
Yeah, we record the sounds of guns, or you can go on YouTube and get recordings of gunshots. And then we dial it down to where you can just barely hear it, and do stuff where you try to solve crosswords, or if it's a child, play games, and then gradually turn up the sound while you're noticing it, but trying to do something pleasant, and to get to the point where you can listen to it louder and louder. And then we practice with firecrackers, small firecrackers, where the person can know the sound is coming and practice it. And then, you know, we have hunting season in Wisconsin, so then you can go out and hear it for real. But the idea is to practice it in a gradual fashion where you feel like, or the child feels like, you can get used to it and you don't have to be afraid of it and startle.
Karen, in the minute we have left, what would be your best advice to people who are grappling with so many different types of phobias?
I would tell them, dare to get treatment. You can find Skype or, you know, online therapists who can do, video chats with you if you're not living near someone. If you go to ADAA.org, the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, you can find people all over the world and in the United States who have expertise treating this, and look for someone who does exposure therapy.
Well, Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Kate. It was a pleasure.
Karen Cassaday is president of the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, and she's owner of the Anxiety Treatment Center of Greater Chicago. She's also a clinical professor at the Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science. This hour, The Morning Show was produced by Niaja Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer and provided technical direction. And I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation about phobias is on the Ideas Network, and you can always join us to further conversations over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.